Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on Thursday, the 10th of November, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Alicia Jones about this Saturday's Coffee and Collections presentation at the City Museum and President Harding's trip to Alaska. We'll find out about Morley and Proverbs shows this weekend at the Goldtown Nickelodeon Theater. We'll also get a preview of this week's presentation on climate change and human rights as part of the Juneau World Affairs Council's Fall Forum on the Politics of Global Climate Change. That's today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like rain in the evening, then a chance of rain and snow later on. Forecast for Veterans Day, mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain in the morning.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A historic storm hitting western and northwest Alaska this week continues, impacting many Alaska Native communities. The storm has potential for causing major coastal flooding, according to the National Weather Service. Claude Denver is Operations Section Chief for the Alaska Division of Homeland Security and Emergency Management. He says the storm is comparable to a hurricane.
85-mile-an-hour winds is equal to a, you know, Category 1 or hurricane. And so the same kind of damage you would expect down the lower 48, you know, hurricane damage, you'll see here. The only difference is that the weather is nice and warm when the hurricanes occur during the summer. And here, of course, it's during the winter, so you have that extra 1-2 punch that goes with not only high winds with damage, but severely cold wind chills.
The storm has caused electricity and communication outages. Early reports indicate about 700 people have moved from their homes to safety in local schools and other shelters. Denver says the storm isn't over and cautions people to be careful when they return home to assess damage.
What we always are concerned about is that, you know, there's probably a lot of compromised structures, you know, some wind damage, there's lots of debris. And we'd always caution folks to, you know, be careful about, you know, negotiating, walking around these areas because they are going to be slip trips and fall hazards, and we want to make sure people are protected.
The state is checking with tribes and city offices to determine damage. The storm is said to be one of the most powerful to hit western Alaska in nearly 40 years. In California, the Berkeley City Council will consider a resolution to honor Geronimo. The resolution to honor the Apache leader was introduced by the city's Peace and Justice Commission. The resolution acknowledges the life of Geronimo and also condemns the use of the name by the U.S. government for military purposes. It refers to the government's announcement in May about the U.S. operation and death of Osama bin Laden. After the announcement, reports surfaced that the operation to kill bin Laden was named Geronimo. Native people and tribal leaders across the country have called on President Obama to apologize. The resolution was considered last month, but it was held off until the council's November agenda for revision. The meeting is scheduled for next week. A First Nations community in Manitoba, Canada is grieving after the death of a 9-year-old boy. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, he was shot dead by his 14-year-old brother in what police are describing as a tragic accident.
The Sag King First Nation was overwhelmed by tragedy last week. Two people died of natural causes, another was murdered, and the latest tragedy involving the 9-year-old. Police say the two brothers were at home when the shooting took place. The 9-year-old was shot once and was taken to hospital, but was pronounced dead on arrival. Police say it's not clear who owned the rifle the boys were handling, but they say at least one parent was home at the time. Family members were distraught, and people on the reserve say they're devastated. Donovan Fontaine, the chief of the Ojibwe community, says it's tragedies such as this one that brings people together.
But these things, you need support for your family members who are grieving. The schools, the teachers are, you know, have to deal with the fallout for the children. So when they really talk about unity coming together, they have to do it year-round, all the time.
Some say living off the land is an important part of Aboriginal culture, so guns are not uncommon. But the shooting underscores the importance of firearm safety. Fontaine said the band council had even talked last month about hunting safety, and that issue will now take on a new tone. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
On this day in 1998, American Indian and Alaska Native veterans were honored by the U.S. Department of Defense. The ceremony featured performances by veterans from Alaska and a special tribute to Navajo Code Talkers. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for National Native News comes from the National Library of Medicine, featuring its new interactive exhibition, Native Voices, examining the concepts of health and medicine among contemporary American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. On the web at nlm.nih.gov/native voices. Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned to KTWO News in Juneau, where we are in day number 4 of our fall membership drive. Now is the time for you to go to your telephone and call 586-3636 or 1-800-478-3636. You can also pledge online by going to www.ktwo.org. Make your tax-deductible donation to public radio that way. If you call in, you'll talk to members of the STEM program with the Juneau Economic Development Council, and also Ken Fix from the Juneau Douglas Planetarium is here. They'll take your pledge of support gladly. Please give us a call right now. Well, you can wait until we have to do this interview first with Alicia McLean and Lisa Jones from the Juneau Douglas City Museum about the Copy and Collections Program this Saturday at 10:30. Alicia, thank you very much for coming on the station today.
Thanks for having me.
Say that one more time, please.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I just had to turn up the microphone just a little bit. So this, tell me about President Harding's trip to Alaska, if you could, please.
Sure. This is going to be a presentation by Jim Garrity, who's a local historian and avid researcher, and he's going to be giving a detailed account of President's visit to the territory of Alaska. This was in 1923, and Harding had set out on what he called his voyage of understanding, and he spent 12 days in the state of territory of Alaska, and this trip had, you know, it was first going to be a couple stops on the West Coast, and it ballooned into over 80 destinations. He was going to go to the Panama Canal and Puerto Rico. And then this was during the summer of 1923, and unfortunately, he didn't make it to all those places. He died in San Francisco on August 2nd. And so a lot of the purpose of his voyage was overshadowed because he died. And so then it was all about, oh, he went on this trip, and he died, you know, shortly after his visit to Alaska. So Jim Garrity has been researching this for a while, and he'll be giving just a lot of information about, you know, where he stopped in our territory, in the territory, and just what he was aiming to do with his visit.
And they call this the Voyage of Understanding?
Yes.
You know what they hope to understand?
You'll have to come on Saturday.
He was in Alaska for 12 days. How many people were in his party? Do you know?
I know he was definitely traveling with his wife Florence, and he had sort of an entourage of people that came with him. I know Hoover was one of the. I think he was a secretary at that time. Secretary of some, he had some position, and was also traveling with him. And so he had, you know, definitely a group of people.
He was the first president to visit Alaska?
Yes. He was the first president to come to Alaska, and was also the first one to kind of express an interest in, you know, finding out what resources Alaska had to offer.
Way back then, such a forward thinker. And that's all happening Saturday at 10:30 at the Juneau Douglas City Museum. It's a coffee collection, so there, I know there's coffee there, right?
Yes. Heritage Coffee provides the coffee each month for our coffee and collection series. And the presentation will be approximately about an hour, and then we usually have time for questions and answers.
And what else is going on at the Juneau Douglas City Museum?
The following weekend, Saturday, November 19th, Get Your Motors Running, Chainsaws and Outboards will be closing. So if you haven't had a chance to come and see that exhibit, this is definitely your time to do that. And we also have recent acquisitions, 2011, which is in the audiovisual gallery, and that's a great it's a smaller exhibit, but it really shows, you know, just kind of some of the highlights of what we've collected over the past year, and it's a good mix of well-known Alaskan artists, both past and present. So there's a painting by Francis Davis. There's a photograph by Trevor Davis. There's photographs by Jack Hermley, paintings by Rima Nyos. There's also some carving by Rick Beasley. And so it's just a nice mixture of, 2D and 3D art that the museum has either purchased or it's been donated to the museum in the past year.
Mm-hmm. And what else is going on?
And then next month, we're kind of, again, highlighting our acquisitions with Rasmussen Retrospective. And this will feature artwork by local artists that we've purchased their artwork through a grant that's called the Art Acquisition Fund. And we've collected 74 works from 31 Juneau artists. And so a portion of this collection will be on display for December and January.
And it's free to get in thanks to some generous donors.
Yes. This month, November, free winter admission is sponsored by Don and Alma Harris.
All right. Alicia Jones from the Juneau Douglas City Museum. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Just if people have questions, they can give us a call at 586-3572. And Jim always does a wonderful job with his presentations. He's done one every year that we've had our coffee and collection series. So I definitely encourage people to stop by on Saturday morning for some hot coffee and a look into history.
And that starts at 10:30, so you should get there a little bit early because I know the seats are go pretty quick.
Yes.
All right, Alicia, thank you for coming down the station today.
Thank you.
Remember, the number to call is 586-3636 or 1-800-478-3636. You can also pledge online by going to www.ktuo.org. We have volunteers standing by from the STEM program with the Juneau Economic Development Council and also the Juneau, the Marie Drake Planetarium is here to take your phone calls of support.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Thursday. It's the 10th of November, 2011. It's the birthday of the man whom Pope Leo X called the wild boar in the vineyard, the monk and theologian Martin Luther, born in Eisleben in Germany, 1483. His father was a farmer. The boy did well at school. At the age of 14, he sang on the streets in return for bread because of the family's financial difficulties. He had a very nice singing voice. He was noticed by a wealthy benefactor who helped pay for his education. He went to the university to study law, and then one night got caught in a terrible thunderstorm, thought he was going to die, made a bargain with Saint Anne that if he was saved, he would become a monk. And so, when he survived, he entered a monastery. Parents were very disappointed that he'd given up his chance to become a lawyer. As a young monk, Luther was obsessed with his own struggle for salvation. He would flagellate himself. He would lie out all night in the snow, did not feel any comfort from it, was tormented. He went off to teach at the university in Wittenberg and went to visit Rome, where he was disgusted by the practices of the church authorities. Luther went back to Wittenberg and decided, after studying the Bible, that the church had it wrong, that salvation did not come from performing acts, but rather from faith alone. He wrote out his argument in a document, mailed a copy of it to the Archbishop of Mainz. On October 31st, 1517, he took a third copy and nailed it onto the door of the church at the University of Wittenberg, which was the custom at the time. The church door functioned like a bulletin board. The Pope threatened him with excommunication in 1520. Luther burnt it publicly, so he was excommunicated and called before the Diet of Worms, where he refused to recant his statements. He was condemned, the writings were burned, and the council declared him an obstinate, schismatic heretic. But Luther had earned the support of Frederick III, who offered him sanctuary and who hid Luther in his castle. And his writings and his ideas set off violent revolutions, peasants against the upper class, and eventually the Reformation. When Luther was 41, he married a 26-year-old ex-nun, Katharina von Bora, whom he had helped to smuggle out of the convent in a barrel of pickled fish. They had a happy marriage. They gardened, played music together, raised 6 children. Martin Luther, who felt that merriment and celebration, dancing and drinking, were acts of rebellion against the devil, who loves not woman, wine, and song, remains a fool his whole life long, said Martin Luther. Here's a poem for today by W.S. Merwin, When the War is Over. When the war is over, we will be proud, of course. The air will be good for breathing at last. The water will have been improved. The salmon and the silence of heaven will migrate more perfectly. The dead will think the living are worth it. We will know who we are, and we will all enlist again. When the War is Over by W.S. Merwin from The Lice, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine. You can read the current issue of Poetry or listen to the monthly Editor's Podcast at poetryfoundation.org. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, combining drug discovery with technology to turn science into diabetes treatments at novonordisk-us.com. Produced by Kathy Roach and Nick Vetter, be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:16 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. We're in day number 4 of our fall membership drive. Right now it's time for you to go to your telephone and call 586-3636 or 1-800-478-3636. You can also pledge online by going to www.ktuo.org and make your support of financial contributions to KTUO right now. In the studio with us now to talk about morally improper greatest hits and more show tonight and Saturday at 9:30 at the Old Town Nickelodeon Theater are Michael Christensen and Eric Caldwell. Thank you so much for coming down the station today.
Thank you for having us.
So first of all, tell me what morally impoverished is.
Morally impoverished is the premier improv group in Juneau. And we've been together for, well...
Yeah, we did our first show in 2004, January 2004, so we're coming up on 8 years now. So we're kind of looking back both at what we've been doing recently, which is more dramatic in nature, a side of improv that not too many people perform, not too many people see, but then we're also doing the more familiar, shorter form games that people are used to and associate with improv in general.
How do you put together an improv show?
Well, there's a number of different ways to do that. The way that we've done it in the past year, we had a very specific format where we had the first page of an unpublished script and used that to lead into a half hour to 45 minute play. With the type of show that we're doing this weekend, it's more we look at the types of games that play to our strengths. Try to keep it varied, try to break it up to where there's not too much of one type of thing over and over and over.
And we picked the things that we like to do, that, mm-hmm. that we enjoy doing, that we find fun.
And that the audience has responded well to over the years.
I would say the most improvisational comedy involves comedy.
Most of it does, especially the comedic. As you say, improv comedy, that's the way it comes out of most people's mouths. But there is improv that is on the more dramatic side, the more serious side, and it was fun to explore that. But at the same time, it does take some energy. It does take a different way of using your brain, and it's nice to get back to, as you say, the comedy.
You just got back from Hawaii, where you took some honors there.
Yes, we performed in Improvaganza, the 6th annual Hawaiian Festival of Improvisational Theater. That's where we brought in the format that we just described of taking the first page of a unproduced play.
And we were the first Alaska improv troupe to perform at a national festival. So,
in this case, the Hawaiians threw us for a little bit of a loop, though. We've been working on developing character, bringing out the more serious side of the plots, and as soon as we read the page, we realized we're in a campy B-movie sci-fi script. So we had to instantly just change our brains over from, okay, we're going to be actors, to, okay, we're going to be Buck Rogers.
Was it fun?
Oh, it was a lot of fun, and the crowds out there are extremely appreciative.
When you bring back, of course, besides Michael's tattoo that he showed me?
Mike brought back multiple tikis. I brought back a tiki as well.
Previously, we had tans, so there's that, and Hawaiian shirts. So, but we brought back, I guess, the relationships that we developed with the other improvers from around the nation who were in the festival, and Eric has been going outside much more than the rest of the group, and we got to meet the people that that he's known from Chicago and from Seattle and places like that.
What was the scene like in Hawaii?
Well, they have two major groups out there that do most of the productions. One of them does some very experimental work. They brought in an improvised silent film, for lack of a better term. They were all dressed as silent film type characters, had an accompanist playing with them. Then they would do silent improv, and very Buster Keaton-esque.
Yeah, so that was a lot of fun.
So were there several of the communities represented in Hawaii?
Yes, we had groups from New York City, Austin, Texas, Phoenix, a couple groups from Oklahoma, a few different places in California,
LA.
Seattle, Washington.
Yeah.
Did everyone have their own style, or did you notice common threads throughout everyone's performances?
There were a lot of different styles. We had everything from a Vietnam War improvised comedy to a couple guys who were rapping to connect their scenes, improvised couples therapy, pretty much the gamut of all the things that you don't necessarily think of when you think of improv. I mean, you think of improv, you don't think of, gee, let's take the Vietnam War and make it funny.
And again, that's not what I think of immediately either. How many people are in Morally Impoverished?
We have 5 people who are performing with us at this time.
We have a new member, and it's going to be her first show.
And she's been working out with the UAS Improv Club, so she's been doing improv for a couple years now, and just a lot of fun to play with, and great to get her on stage and to have those connections with the UAS community.
So this is Greatest Hits and More tonight and Saturday at 9:30 at the Gold Town Nickelodeon Theater. What's the Greatest Hits part and what's the More part?
The Greatest Hits would be the short-form comedy that people have come to know and love over the years. The More part is we are bringing out a couple of long-form pieces, including a piece on Saturday called The Bat, where we improvise in the dark.
How often do you get together to rehearse improvising?
At this point, pretty much weekly.
Do any developed performance material from the rehearsals?
Absolutely. In fact, one of the things that people will be seeing tonight is called the Amazing Game-O-Matic, where we will take a suggestion of an improv game that people think should exist but doesn't. We'll take whatever they give us, and we'll turn it into an improv game on the spot.
Like we said, it sounds fun. What time is it? It starts at 9:30, and what does it cost to get in?
It will be $10 at the door. We also have advance tickets available at the bookstores for a little bit less and online through jhc.org/buy-tickets.
All right. I've been talking to Michael Christensen and Eric Caldwell about the Morally Impoverished show tonight and Saturday at 9:30. Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Nope.
Thank you so much, Jeff.
I love to laugh. I love to giggle from my head to my toes. It makes me feel so good. Now I can be silly and I can be serious, but I love to laugh, oh, every chance I get. Till my knees get weak and I fall down to my side, hey, and I laugh till I cry and I can't stop. And it's hard to breathe, but the more I laugh, the better I feel. Oh, 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 oh. I love to laugh, oh, I love to giggle from my head to my toes. It makes me feel so good. Now I can be silly and I can be serious, but I love to laugh, hey, every chance I get. When it's eyes glittin' and ribs shaking and tummy tickling and happy, making it silly, giggling and gut busting, the more I laugh, the better I feel. Oh, 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 oh. I love to laugh. My head to my toes, it makes me feel so good. Now I can be silly and I can be serious, but I love to laugh every chance I get. So open up wide and let out some sunshine, share something happy, making it friends and family. It won't cost a penny, or it tickles funny, or it brightens your day and makes you feel so good. From your head down to your toes, and chase the blues away. Oh, 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 oh. Take the breath and smile, just share a funny story. It'll make you feel so good. Share a funny story. Share a funny story.
In honor of World Hooping Day this Saturday, they're going to be doing a performance and participation series of exercises at the Juneau Arts and Humanities Council, JAACC, from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. And it's absolutely free. There's the dance performance by the Off the Hook Honey, and also live drumming by the Noodle of Doom group. And that starts at 2 o'clock and goes till 5 o'clock, and you do not have to have a hula hoop to participate. In the studio with us now are people here to talk about the Fall Forum on the politics of global climate change. Bob Shorter is in the studio to talk to us a little bit, give us an overview of the week, and also Jennifer Barcelos and Jennifer Marlowe are here to talk about social justice and climate change. Bobby, want to introduce yourself in the forum, please?
Sure. Thanks, Jeff. I'm Bob Shorter. I'm a board member of the Juno World Affairs Council, and I'd just like to invite all of you to come to the forum this year. This year's forum is titled The Politics of Global Climate Change. It'll be a multi-day event. We're focusing on the ramifications of rising temperatures and the melting of Arctic sea ice, as well as the threat of water shortages, human rights concerns, and international security challenges. The forum will begin this evening at 7 o'clock. With a session from 7 to 9:30 today. We'll be meeting tomorrow from 1 to 4:30, and then from 5 to 6:45, and 7 to 9:30 on Friday. We'll be doing a presentation as part of the Evening at Egan Forum, and we continue with events all day on Saturday. And it'll be really interesting. Juno World Affairs Council has organized this event and has a number of speakers from within Alaska, as well as visiting experts, two of whom are with us today, Jeff.
Jennifer Marlowe and Jennifer Barcelos, both from the University of Washington's area. Tell me a little bit about yourself, Jennifer.
Sure. My name is Jennifer Barcelos, and I'm an attorney based in Seattle, Washington, and I work at the University of Washington. Our project, the 3 Degrees Project, is housed in the law school, and we work on climate justice issues.
My name is Jen Marlowe. I co-direct 3 Degrees Project with Jenny Barcelos, and we look at the human story of climate change and try to get more into the heart of the climate crisis by seeing how climate impacts people's lives and their aspirations for the future.
What does the 3 degrees refer to?
Well, we call ourselves 3 degrees because the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, predicts global average temperature rise of 3 degrees Celsius over the course of the 21st century. And because we have failed internationally to cap global warming pollution, we're looking to inherit very likely a 3 degree world, if 3 degree Celsius world, if not warmer. And there have been international lobbying efforts to cap global warming at 2 degrees Celsius, but those efforts have failed to produce any legally binding cap on carbon. And so without that progress in the international community, and even with it at this point, we're committed to a certain level of warming in the atmosphere. And as lawyers, we feel like we have a moral obligation to prepare the world for what scientists are telling us the world's going to look like.
Connect the dots, please. Climate change and human rights.
Sure. We like to think of climate change as an amplifier of threat and problems, or an exacerbator of existing inequities and insecurities. And so we believe that many human rights violations are going to occur or become worse because of climate change. And so when we first started this work 4 years ago, we were looking at the body of human rights law to search for solutions and helping people who are feeling the burdens of climate change.
And then the information I saw talked about the basic human rights of food and water and clean air.
Yeah, so we have a 5-part framework that we use when looking at climate justice or climate change and human rights as it relates to climate adaptation, and we look at food and water, health, security, equity, and justice as part of that framework. So that's really how we focus our work at the university and beyond.
And under the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which is one of the covenants under the United Declaration on Human Rights that was agreed to by the UN in 1948, there are things such as the right to survival. And under the right to survival, there are human rights to food and water and health, which are threatened by climate change globally. We work with an atmospheric scientist at University of Washington. His name's David Battisti, and he works on studying food security and how global agricultural production is going to be affected by climate warming or by climate change. And his general rule of thumb is that with every 1 degree Celsius rise in temperature, we're looking at a 10% decrease in agricultural productivity for major cereal grains such as rice, maize, corn, things, wheat, things that people that rely foods that people rely on for survival. So if we're looking at a 3 degrees Celsius global average temperature rise predicted by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we're looking at a blanket 30% decline in agricultural productivity for major crops that people rely on for survival. So when we talk about human rights, that's what we're talking about.
Talk about the progress and theory of change.
Well, we've been frustrated, as probably many have been, at the lack of progress at the international level. There's a meeting in Durban called the Conference of the Parties 17, or COP 17, where basically the world stage is going to decide the future of the Kyoto Protocol, which expires in 2012. And the Kyoto Protocol is a legally binding agreement by member countries, the U.S. of which the U.S. is not a ratifying member. Global parties are going to decide the fate of the only legally binding international instrument we have curbing global warming. And it's very clear from work that we've read and people that we've talked to that there's very likely to be very limited progress that's going to happen at the international meeting at the COP this year. It's very unlikely that Kyoto is going to continue. The United States has said that it will not agree to any legally binding emissions unless China and India, other major emitters, will. China has basically said it will not agree to any legally binding cap on emissions. And Europe is definitely willing to play as long as the U.S. plays too. So you see that it's going to take a major change of mind of one of these major players to actually cap carbon emissions at the international level. So our theory of change is really looking past the international community and looking more at what communities can do at the local level to make decisions about the fate of their own communities and how to leverage the local decision-making into national and international policies or laws that can help people adapt to the changes that we're facing. So an example in Alaska, this is probably really controversial, but an example in Alaska is potentially looking at changing the hunting season so that it's more in line with the shifts in migration of hunting animals so that people can rely on the local sources of sustenance to help them adapt to changes that they're facing. So shifting the laws to be more in line with the changes in seasons that we're seeing that is amplified by climate change.
Tell me about, I've heard multinational corporations as the villains and sometimes governments as the villains. Is there a consensus as to who the guilty parties are?
The United States, I think that's one consensus globally, because the United States is taking a back seat on any meaningful legal action to cap emissions.
I think the entire global economic system is to blame for the runaway emissions that we have right now. And the United States certainly has played a major role in that. So it's corporations, but it's also governments that are promoting a certain type of material growth-driven capitalist structure that doesn't really have a way of capping emissions and still growing material wealth.
What do you see as a solution? I'm sure there's a number of solutions.
Well, we don't work... There are solutions, I think.
I guess feasible solutions.
Feasible solutions. So we work on that. So that most people who work on climate change focus on mitigation, so reducing emissions. And I think that we've been very frustrated with that process, and it's extremely important. But we feel like we have a responsibility as attorneys and as ethical citizens to work on adaptation, because we've already committed to a certain amount of warming, as Jen has said. We're likely, even if we stopped emitting right now, to see a 3 degrees Celsius rise or longer in the carbon that we put out into the atmosphere. Some of that is going to persist for up to 10,000 years before being reabsorbed. And so we need to be creating adaptation policies that can help people deal with the consequences of global climate change that we've already created and that we're continuing to create. So the the solutions for adaptation lie, as Jen was saying, in many of these local initiatives. And then I think states can do a lot as well. So federal climate policy and international climate policy are really at a standstill, but state climate policy has been moving forward, and states have really taken a lead, and cities have taken a lead. So,
what can people in Juneau and Alaska do in addition to changing the hunting seasons?
Well, one thing that we're going to talk about tomorrow at the forum is we've been doing a lot of work on scenario planning or scenario thinking. So using tools for looking out into the future 30, 50, 80, 100 years, anticipating climate impacts at those timescales, and then working backwards to figure out what sort of local decisions we can make now to help to mitigate for those problems, help to buffer our communities for the climate impacts that we're likely to see and other impacts that we're likely to see. So we're really trying to promote and test this way of thinking called scenario planning that's used by the military. It's used by many of the major corporations in their decision making, and we're trying to bring it sort of down to be used at the community level as well for decision making.
I'm talking to Jen Barcelos and Jen Marlowe about the 3 Degrees Project and their participation in the Fall Forum on the Politics of Global Climate Change. And talk to me a little bit about the Sightline Institute, please.
Well, the Sightline Institute is a think tank in Seattle that looks at basically how to shift institutions to be more progressively aligned with the world's future. So an example of what Sightline works on is looking at tax shifts. A good example of that is what BC has done with a carbon tax, where you shift taxes to tax what is not helping a community and provide a tax relief for what is helping a community. So in BC's case, with the infestation of the park beetle in the forest in BC, the prime minister and other parties, or the other political players in BC, passed a carbon tax to basically tax the polluter, push the burden of pollution onto the polluter, and take the burden of pollution off of the citizens. And they passed a revenue-neutral tax that became very politically charged issue with the next presidential election in BC. But it was the only initiative of that nature in North America. So that's just an interesting example of the work that has been done in BC. It's something that Sightline in Seattle is trying to promote with driver insurance. So people that drive more should pay more insurance. Drive as you pay ideas. So sort of that shift of the cost burden on people that are using the resource or polluting the environment versus taxing at a different level that doesn't recognize the inputs and the burdens that we create by our actions. So it's a think tank in Seattle. We worked with them to try to look at how to promote fair and equitable climate policy in Washington State. Because as Jenny said, states have been very out front after the failure of climate legislation at the national level. And one thing that the state of Washington was doing was working with seven other states in the Western Climate Initiative to pass a regional cap and trade program where you would trade carbon permits and thereby provide a market incentive for reducing carbon. And one of the things that we are looking at is the regressivity, or how regressive pricing carbon can be on the poorest citizens of a state, and to try to look at ways of ameliorating the impacts of climate policy on the most vulnerable or the most marginalized people. So when you talk about climate justice, it's not just assessing the impacts of climate change on the most marginalized communities in our society, but also looking at how climate policies themselves affect the more vulnerable communities. So that's interesting work that Sightline's doing, and you could check out their blog, which is called The Daily Score, which is great.
When I think of human rights, I think of third world countries. Is that what we're talking about, or are we talking about human rights in general around the world?
We're talking about human rights in general. We believe that marginalized people in developed countries as well are going to be primarily the victims of climate change. And if you look at one example is just the community that was impacted most by Hurricane Katrina. So there's not an absolute causal link between climate change and Hurricane Katrina itself, but it's seen by many scientists as certainly an exacerbator and something that made that hurricane stronger. And the communities that were most impacted were the poorest people that couldn't get out of town easily. Those are the people that were displaced. And there are sort of systemic reasons and institutionalized reasons for why certain people bear the burden of climate change as opposed to others. So if you don't have a car, it's harder for you to get out of the path of a hurricane, for example.
What got you interested in the first place in climate change and human rights?
For me, it was the Inuit petition filed by Sheila Watt-Cloutier she's an Inuit woman who lives in the Arctic North. And she and her people filed a petition against the United States alleging that failure to cap global warming emissions was threatening the very survival of the polar Arctic Inuit people. And they filed that petition against the United States and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in 2005 or 2007, I believe, somewhere in that time frame. And the Inter-American Commission looked at the case and said that they didn't have enough information to make a conclusive link between climate change and human rights. So they basically said, interesting, but this is a non-justiciable issue. We can't look at it. We'll agree to a hearing where we can elaborate on what those rights impacts are, but that's as far as we'll go. So for me, it was the voice of people who climate change, whose lives were being directly threatened by climate change that made me think of the importance of that message and the sort of human story and the heart of the story, which is that people who are doing very little, if nothing, to contribute to global warming pollution are oftentimes bearing a disproportionate burden of climate impacts. And that, for me, was the reason why I wanted to learn more about climate change and apply a human rights lens to it. Because in the end, what is it? It's not just about mitigating emissions or putting a cap on carbon. I mean, all these things have a heartless, soulless quality to them. When you talk about it, it's very technical, very wonky. But when you actually look into the face of someone whose very survival is threatened by global warming, then you start to think really differently. Are we talking about it in the wrong way? Are we not moving people to understand what the real meaning of this is that it's definitely not something technology is going to fix. It's going to take all of our hearts and all of our minds and all of our ability to see someone else's lives in our own that really is going to make a difference and help people shift what they think climate change is and what it means.
Jennifer?
I've been very concerned about climate change for most of my life, and I had the privilege of being trained by Al Gore as one of his volunteer presenters for the Climate Project in 2006. I was part of one of the first training classes of people that were trained to give his Inconvenient Truth slideshow. And I took some time off and traveled around the United States giving this slideshow in public libraries at night or in high school auditoriums. And it really started after giving the slideshow over and over again and realizing what spoke to people in these communities. It was very clear that these human impacts were the part of the story that was the most compelling, both for me and for the audiences that I was sharing that story with. And so I decided to go to law school to see if I could gain some tools to actually assist the people who are suffering these burdens. And Jen and I met our very first week of law school. We both came to law school for the very same reason, to work on the human impacts of climate change. And so that's sort of our story, our origin story.
You ever feel like you're running on an uphill battle?
Absolutely. But it's worth it.
And your participation in the forum is not going to be limited to this presentation tomorrow, is it?
We're giving an overview of our climate justice framework for about an hour, and then we're going to do a workshop on scenario planning for Juno, and we'd love people to come out. So we have about a 3.5-hour slot tomorrow, but we'll be attending the forum eagerly, listening and participating as audience members for the rest of it.
I've had people on the air who insist that there's no such thing as a global warming. What do you have to say about that?
Well, I think that there's a lot of benefits, a lot of co-benefits to thinking through some of the challenges that we see, whether or not climate change is real. So if you think about promoting human rights, promoting security of communities, promoting
people's ability to sustain themselves. I think that those are all valuable goals, whether or not climate change is real. So that's what I say, is it's all those things are worth doing anyway. And if we can use climate change to help make those somewhat tired ideas, I mean, people are sort of have that sense of, oh, well, you know, what's happening in Somalia? Oh, we've heard about the droughts and the famine in Somalia before, but it's the worst ever in history what's happening in Somalia, and yet we hardly hear about it. And I think one of the benefits of climate change is it is one of those problems that's extremely real to certain people, despite what some climate deniers might say. It's actually in the face of people and their, and it's threatening their ability to live out their everyday ordinary lives. And so if we can help them fulfill their aspirations for the future, whether we say it's because of climate change or not, it's a worthy goal.
And we absolutely believe in that climate change is happening. There's scientific consensus, 98% of climate scientists in the world agree that it's happening and agree that it's being caused by human beings. And so I think we're completely aligned, and we work very closely with a whole lot of scientists who have spent time going over the science with us. And we teach a climate justice course at the University of Washington. This is our third year that we'll be teaching it, and we teach it in conjunction with a climate scientist. And so I would just say, for people who don't believe it's happening, to read a little bit more about it. And the goals of climate justice, as Jen was saying, they go beyond this argument of whether or not it's happening. This is the next step. This is sort of how to deal with the major problems in the world. And we take climate change as something that's making those major problems worse. But our solutions are about fixing and addressing those root problems themselves.
Is there a website you could tell people about, or maybe a couple of websites?
Yeah, it's www.3degreeswarmer.org, and it's all spelled out.
And your presentation is tomorrow at what time?
We start at 1:30.
1 o'clock.
Bob, you want to guide people to information from the Juno World Affairs Council, please?
You bet, Jeff. Again, the Juno World Affairs Council is presenting the Politics of Global Climate Change, the 2011 World Forum. The program will commence this evening at 7 p.m. at the Egan Library. Tomorrow afternoon from 1 to 4:30, our two guests here will be doing their presentation and following a workshop format. And then there will be other events tomorrow, including the Evening at Egan Forum at 7 o'clock tomorrow night, as well as events all day on Saturday. We look forward to seeing a good deal of Juno there, and I think we have the right weather for it.
All right, I've been talking to Bob Schroeder and also Jen Marlowe and Jennifer Barcelos about the full forum on the politics of global climate change. If you need more information about that, go to the Juno World Affairs Council website here in town. Anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask?
Thank you very much for hosting us.
Thank you for coming by.
Thanks.
Most people think great God will come from the sky.
3:55, and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau, and in the studio with me now is Nancy DeChuni. Nancy, you're looking beautiful today.
No, don't do that to me. Don't do that to Nancy, actually.
Andy Klein filling in for Nancy DeChuni, who couldn't be here today, but we have just a couple minutes to go before we go into All Things Considered.
Our special pledge drive version of All Things Considered, so encouraging people to give us a call here. But, yeah, this weekend for Arts Up, this is the last weekend of Greece over at Thunder Mountain. So that's running Thursday, Friday, Saturday at 7:30. Sing-along matinee will be presented at 2 p.m. Sunday, November 6th. That sounds like a lot of fun. There's a 50s oldies dinner before the TMHS play Greece. At the School Commons from 5 to 6, November 11th and 12th. That's going to be fun. Of course, the politics of global climate change, that is a big conference that's happening, a series of sessions out at UAS, November 10th, today through the 13th. That's all through the weekend. So that's a really interesting series of things being set up. Juneau World Affairs Council setting that up. Goldtown Nickelodeon this weekend, Morley Improverished, is happening. Greatest Hits and More, 9:30 to 10:30 this weekend. That's happening. That's tonight, Thursday, and Saturday, November 12th at the Goldtown. House on a Haunted Hill is a movie that's playing there Friday, November 11th. And then Being Elmo, a really cool documentary about the guy who is Elmo. And he's a very interesting guy, puppeteer Kevin Clash. And that's happening. Showtime's Monday, November 14th. And Tuesday, November 15th, 7 p.m. shows happening there. Thursday, the rest of the time here, Thursday, of course, the global climate change, as I said, there's open mic night at the Alaskan tonight. Tomorrow, it's Veterans Day, so happy Veterans Day to all of those of you who've served and families of those who have served. We appreciate that. And museums and libraries are closed, but there's a kids' night out, Arts for Youth Dance Studios happening. Let's see, I don't know quite where that is. Okay, we'll move on there. You can contact the Jack to figure out where that is. And Carrie Groovin and the Wrist Rockets are playing at the Alaskan Bar Friday night. Should I keep going?
Yeah, we got a couple of minutes here.
Couple more minutes, okay. For Saturday, really cool. It's a pretty full-looking weekend here. The JEDC STEM office at 603 West Willoughby Ave. There's a program for kids 4 years and up to tinker, explore, invent, create, learn, and imagine. And the info and registration is at www.stemak.org/Saturday-thing. It's called the Saturday Thing. It's happening there. Saturday Crafters and Farmers Market happening at the Airport Mall. Ski Swap. So Ski Swap weekend. Ski Swap at Centennial Hall. It starts at 10 a.m. on Saturday. Oh, boy, I forgot about that. Man, got to get in line early for the Ski Swap. That's happening at Centennial Hall. Friends of the Alaska State Museum present Power Steering the Color Wheel. Yeah, prevent it. They don't prevent it. They present it. And that's happening at the State Museum. Local historian Jim Garrity will present President Harding's visit to Alaska for the City Museum Coffee and Collection Series. And there's a taffy dance at the Nugget Mall also. Ballroom dance happening at the Jack Saturday from 7 to 11. Native History Month, Alaska Robotics screening and DVD release at the JDHS Auditorium Saturday, collection of short films from the last 5 years, tickets at alaskarobotics.com, and I want to put in a little plug, KXLL is sponsoring the after party for the Alaska Robotics screening, so the after party is over at Mandy's at the Breakwater right after the screening. Bring your ticket over, you'll get free goodies and hors d'oeuvres and some drink specials and stuff like that for the 21 and over set at Mandy's at the Breakwater right after the Alaska Robotics premiere of their latest DVD. That should be really fun.
Lots of stuff going on. Check out their website at www.jahc.org. And in the meantime, I'd like to thank the people from the STEM program at the Juneau Economic Development Council for answering the telephones for the past couple of hours. Now Northwind Architects are here to take your pledges of support. Got some surprises coming up during All Things Considered, so stay tuned. You're tuned to KTOO in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ock Bay area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on digital channel 871. KRNN can be heard at digital channel 872, and KXLL can be found at 873. We're also online at www.ktuo.org, and that's where you can go to make your pledge of financial support to KTUO. Give us a call, 586-3636 or 1-800-478-3636. Any of you want to get any words of wisdom in the next 15 seconds?
I just want to say anyone out there is a fan of Jeff Brown and Juneau Afternoon, give us a call right now, 586-3636. We'll be talking to you during ATC.